All right. So, hi. Good morning. My name is Rishi. I'm 19 years old, and today is the 25th of January, 2023, and I'm here in Richmond, Virginia, and with my One Small Step partner, Chris.
Hello, Rishi, and my name is Chris, and I am 59 years old, very soon to be 60, and today's date is January 25th of 2023. I am in Roanoke, Virginia, and I'm here with my One Step Closer partner, Rishi.
So I'm reading your bio here, Chris. You're the youngest of three children. Your parents' families lived in the same Sicilian village. Your paternal grandmother was godmother to your maternal grandmother, and you grew up in Long Island, but ended up going to college in the Appalachian Mountains of far southwestern Virginia. Professionally, you said you've been something of a gypsy, an explorer. You began your professional life as a journalist, a writer, and a columnist. And you have also been a banker, fundraiser, salesman, union rep, and industrial scale operator. Very interesting.
And Rishi, I see that you are a university student studying at VCU in Richmond, originally from Chicago, Illinois. You're guaranteed a BS/MD combined degree. You're in a guaranteed BS/MD combined degree program there, but you've recently been on a journey to redefine what you want with your time and where you can give the most in the ways that you want to give. You're seeking freedom for yourself, connection with others, and you've been on a personal adventure to define your growth and direction. You've recently found that listening and learning from others is a key part of this time. That's wonderful, very impressive.
So, Chris, I really want to ask you, why are you here today? Why'd you want to participate in the One Small Step?
You know, Rishi, when I first stumbled upon the information about this, it aligned with a deep concern of mine about where we're heading as a country in terms of the divisions between us. And I thought there's been no time in my life at almost 60 years old that maybe this type of initiative could be more useful and important. People say, we're a divided nation, and there's truth to that. But in my experience over 6 decades, we've always been divided to some extent. My earliest experiences that I can remember, one of my earliest was listening around my dinner table to my sister, who's 10 years older, who was very much a member of the counterculture, debating with my parents, who were of the so-called greatest generation, the issues of the day. And some of those, discussions became quite animated. And growing up in a family of articulate, opinionated, passionate Sicilians, debate and discussion was kind of the currency of a lot of our family gatherings. And we covered the range of, opinions and ideologies and perspectives. But those were always grounded in a sense of mutual respect, respect for each other's dignity, respect for each other's intelligence and love. And they never resulted in anyone getting up or storming away from the table or deciding not to speak with someone else or engaging in name calling. And I just feel very strongly that we need to get back to that sense that, it's been one of the fundamental beliefs of most of my adult life that people of good conscience can disagree on issues of great substance and import, but do so in a way that does respect each other's dignity and quality as a human being, and that those discussions are fruitful and productive and necessary.
I loved hearing that. I want to say that. The dinner table is a beautiful thing, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about that. That's really
Oh,
powerful.
excellent. So, turning that around, why did you want to participate in one small step?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, a lot of what I talked about when I first reached out with my bio speaks to a lot of it. I am in a space where I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And so the certain demographic there with a big, large public school, predominantly white, and then coming to Richmond, a lot more diverse. There's a lot of different communities that I've been in. And also being a college student, there's a lot of strong opinions within that world as well. And so it's, for me, being able to step outside of just what is my immediate bubble. And that's one thing that I really try to be intentional about when I can, is how do I stay away from just seeing what's in the bubble around me? Mm-hmm. And I hoped coming here that I would be able to expand outside of that space, see, you know, understand new perspectives, understand your perspective. And really, I found that I learn a lot anytime I choose to listen to somebody else's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very powerful thing. And so this was an opportunity to continue that journey for me.
Excellent. Excellent. So go ahead.
Are you sure?
Sure, please.
So I wanna jump into one first about you, because I'm so curious. You've been in a lot of different places professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And to me that means a lot of different communities,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of different viewpoints, and you've seen politics change way more, you know, than I have. And so how has your professional world influenced your beliefs and viewpoints the most? What are the most like big turning points that you see?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny because I sort of started my professional life in the mid 80s. That's when I graduated from college and started working at a newspaper. Mm-hmm. And that was during, you know, it was during the second term of Ronald Reagan's, you know, presidency. And it's interesting because, you know, again, I think, you know, there have always been, like I said, I think there's always been, you know, certainly divides over, you know, over issues and stuff. But it seemed like, as you know, from, you know, even though there was very strong divides and very strong opinions at that time, you know, in the country, and of course being in journalism, you get to, and especially being as a columnist, you get to write about that and you get to explore your opinion. And you know, just, you know, full disclosure, I tend to be of what would be, I hate to labels to pigeonhole myself, but I tend to be of what would be considered today a progressive mindset. And I was working at a newspaper in Bristol, Virginia, where it was, you know, in a pretty conservative community. So, you know, I really had to learn in, you know, writing about my opinions to do so in a way that was, I would say, you know, direct in terms of talking about what I believe, but also respectful in terms of acknowledging that there were other people who are going to be reading that who did not. As far as I think where things started to turn, in my opinion, when our media landscape started expanding, first mm-hmm. with talk radio, when that became a national phenomenon, and you know, before that point, most talk radio was local, and then you started getting large syndicated programs of people on both sides who had, you know, very distinct points of view. And there seemed to be a desire to sort of veer towards the confrontation, you know, end of discussions, mm-hmm. because that seemed to generate, you know, more listeners and more passion. And then once the development of social media came and we started getting first the blogosphere and then social media and the internet and stuff, that's when I think things really exploded. Because, you know, prior to that time, I still grew up at a point where, you know, most every household got one or two newspapers. There were three channels of, you know, that most people watched, and, you know, the national mm-hmm. news. And we all kind of had a common source of information that mm-hmm. we would glean from and then format our opinions. And then I think we started getting more narrowly into spaces where we could just kind of be in echo chambers where we're talking and listening to people who believe as we do. And I think as that happened, some of those divisions got hardened, and that people started not hearing anything but what confirmed their their worldviews already, or their predetermined biases. And I think that's mm-hmm. when we kind of started going further down this road. Now, in terms of you at 19, you know, you've grown up with social media, the internet, and all that. That's been, you know, a part of your, you know, cultural landscape, I guess, probably as far back as you can remember. How do you feel about it, about its impact on our sort of national discourse?
Yes, absolutely. Don't know anything other than the social media world for sure. And it was very meaningful listening to you share the changes as different media forms mm-hmm. kind of developed, right? Because that's something that I don't see. And so on the kind of end of it, where it's social media, the most interesting thing as you were talking that came to my mind is that I have just gotten into social media for me, it's more the first time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really involved in a lot of the social media world in my high school years, when most people are very, very intensely involved with social media. Mm-hmm. And now as I'm transitioning into a professional phase where I'm looking into creating a blogging and actually getting into the world of consulting, but mm-hmm. with that means taking on business in social media. Mm-hmm. And what I'm learning about a lot is how things go viral, mm-hmm. right? This concept. And you said it perfectly, right? This idea that these things will gain listeners if they're controversial. Mm-hmm. And so it really put the picture together as we're sitting here today that yes, absolutely, that social media is that. There's the amount of content that I see and consume that is so far on an aggressive front, and the opposite side of that, you know, aggressive front is, it's honestly scary mm-hmm. oftentimes. Mm-hmm. I think what also happens is the echo chamber, the mob mentality, I think, mm-hmm. and I don't like that term really. It makes it feels very de-individualizing, mm-hmm. but there's definitely an element of, if I see somebody who I respect post a certain piece of information, same thing I think with the world of television news, mm-hmm. That I'm immediately going to agree with that. And I think that absolutely plays a huge, huge role. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of bring it back, because as a columnist and a journalist, like, that's a very interesting space to be in. Mm-hmm. How did that, in terms of timeline, transfer or translate to the social media world, to television news becoming more with the kind of the big giants that we have now? How did that kind of translate in your life?
Well, again, you know, this was right around the time of the second term of the Reagan administration. So it was pre most of these other things. You know, it was a few years later, after I'd left the newspaper business, that the talk radio phenomenon really started taking shape. But you could sort of see in my perspective the seeds of where we were going, because I don't know if in your history, how much was covered about, you know, there was a scandal in the second term of the Reagan administration called Iran-Contra, and it had to do with issues of selling arms to, you know, rebels in Central America. You're familiar with it. And and you started to see where, you know, there was a polarization between people who believed one thing about, you know, about that situation, that, you know, who were very much supporters of the administration, and another, that there were people who were very much critical of the administration. And you started to see, and that's where I started to see a lot of a lot of ire being thrown at network news, in the terms of they're biased, they're covering this, they're just being critical, you know. And and then around that time, there was a nomination to the Supreme Court of a gentleman by the name of Robert Bork, who Reagan had nominated as the Supreme Court, and, you know, that was going to fundamentally change the the makeup of the court. And a lot of folks on who were very much on the pro-choice side vigorously opposed that nomination, and he ended up withdrawing or whatever. But, you know, just as we see today, you started to see those fault lines really starting to materialize. So I think the events of the day were moving us in that direction. And then the addition of this other factor of this expanded media universe that came years later started exploiting those differences. Now, you know, for you, as somebody who grew up in Chicago, you know, I grew up in Long Island, New York, you grew up in what I would assume would be a pretty diverse community. You know, where, when did you start experiencing, or did you from a very early age start noticing, you know, these kind of divisions being really starting to take hold?
That's a very good question. So I will start with the fact that I grew up in the suburbs. So in the suburbs that I was at, it was, I would say, my school, big public high school, like 3,000 kids, and more than half were white. And then we had a good like 20% Asian, and then 20% Hispanic, I think is my approximation right now. I don't know the exact numbers. And so what the very like forefront was the difference in districting. And I always remember, because parents and family friends would make a point of this. And it was different kind of socioeconomic groups that they associated with certain ethnic and racial groups. And that became a lot of, how do I say? It was not a very friendly conversation when that came into play. And I, at that time, was not as much in touch with the different viewpoints in a way that I could articulate and understand very well. And so what I had, you know, begun to see is that mindset being imposed upon not only myself, but I see it especially, you know, I was very grateful to have parents that did not usually delve too deep, but I know family friends where students who I knew, who I, you know, I had friends in high school, friends in middle school, who very much took on those mentalities that was like, if you look like this, then I associate you with this. And there is a negative, there's a, I don't want to be around you. And so you'd have like the classic high school, like cohorts based on racial and ethnic groups, and which in and of itself is not great, but it's not problematic until I think you reach the point of, I don't want to associate with you because of what my parents have told me. And so that's like the first most vivid example that still to this day, and, you know, here in college, in a very diverse, you know, school, university, VCU, one of the reasons I came here is because I loved that there were so many different groups of people, different backgrounds, and in the all contexts. And I sit here and I see those sentiments continuing, and the fact that those come from parents is very disheartening. Disappointing. And so that's where I come from a lot when I think about that. Yes,
you know, it's really interesting to hear you talk about that, because, you know, I almost went through a reverse phenomenon from you, in that I grew up on Long Island. I mean, the particular community I grew up in, Freeport, which is on Long Island, was very, what I would say, you know, racially diverse for its time. I mean, the village I grew up in was probably about one third white, one third black, one third Latino. So, and of course, we had smaller percentages of Asians and other, you know, mixed in. So, you know, and of course, and when you're teenagers and stuff, you know, we grew up where there were, you know, there were conflicts in school between this group and that group, these social groups and all, but we very much grew up in my experience, you know, around each other, you know, classmates of each other, you know, on sports teams together, sharing locker rooms and stuff. So it was, you know, even though there were certainly prejudices, you know, I always laugh when, you know, people say, you know, talk about racism in the South, and it's like, you know, I grew up in the North in New York on Long Island, and believe me, among certain groups, I heard some of those same epithets thrown around just as vigorously as they were in the South. But when I came, when I went to school, and I did end up going to school where I did in far Southwest Virginia, you know, I was going to a school now that was probably 90 to 95% white, and you know, and that was kind of a cultural, you know, experience for me, you know, in the sense that, you know, where I had grown up around, you know, so many other types. Now I was among folks who had never grown up around, you know, people, you know, and any number of people who are demonstrably different from them. And that made for, you know, some really interesting conversations, experiences, sometimes, you know, arguments. And, you know, it, you know, so it's really interesting for me to hear you say, but I agree with, you know, what you say is, you know, often so much of what we bring into our adult lives is the baggage that we grew up with, you know, and like yourself, you know, my parents were very, I mean, my mother and father would have described themselves as conservative. So, you know, politically, by the time I started coming into my own, we were kind of on different sides of the equation, but the entire time I was growing up, we were forbidden to ever use any kind of epithet in our house of any kind, racial, ethnic, homophobic, you know, none of that was permitted. And the reason for that was they believed that was not the way decent people talk. That was not the way educated people talk. That was not the way civilized people talk. That, you know, using any kind of epithet for another group and dehumanizing them in that way was just not permitted. And, you know, even though we would end up on different sides of many issues, whether it be affirmative action or LGBTQ rights or whatever, you know, that's why I say there was always sort of a foundation of dignity and respect in there, because even though we might disagree on the policy or how it should or how certain things should manifest themselves in law, we agreed with the fact that everybody had the right to be respected and and as an individual, and everybody had the right to individual dignity.
I really love that. I think that's an understatement. I think that's an incredibly powerful differentiation. And as much as, and I think, you know, we came to this conversation where you had said that at the forefront is respect, but being able to differentiate that respect from disagreement, like you said, and it's, and I guess I want to ask you, do you feel that, you know, with the classmates that you had in college and maybe now, you know, where you are now, and would you consider where you are at right now, like predominantly one politically leaning or demographically leaning?
Where I am personally, you know, it's kind of a nuanced answer because I have a reflexive resistance to pigeonholing myself with labels because, you know, I always say, you know, I always get the feeling the minute I say I am this, that, you know, there's a whole set of assumptions that come with that and that all those assumptions may not be true. But I mean, I would say I am, you know, I do tend to lean towards the progressive, you know, end of the spectrum in that, you know, I, you know, my view of society is that, you know, we should always be in a space of trying to move towards more justice for, you know, more individuals that, and that, and that there are inequities in our society that have sort of been entrenched over generations, whether it be through, you know, first through law, and then maybe later on just through practice, and then maybe later on just through attitude. and that, you know, we have to be able, as we're doing here, to talk about those and see if we can't move past the very things you were talking about. So those hardened assumptions that we grew up with that have never been thought through or never been discussed in any way to really dissect them and to understand that, wait a second, why do I believe this? Do I believe this because it's something in my heart or in my experience, or do I believe it because it's what I've been told? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I am. Now, it's interesting because, I mentioned in my bio, I'm an industrial scare operator. I basically work mm-hmm. in what right now in a metal recycling company, basically a scrapyard. I can assure you, I don't talk politics there, because I know I know for a fact I am on the opposite end of the spectrum from almost everyone that I work with. Mm-hmm. But the people I work with, mostly men, almost all white, I truly love those guys. We work together every day. We have to work, as a team. We depend on each other. When my wife was sick a few weeks ago, I was having to leave work to take her to the doctor, they were always asking me and concerned about it. So I know from experience that common heart of humanity is there within all of us. If we could, in my view, just break away some of these barriers we have surrounding it, so that we can, we can realize that, okay, you believe this, I believe that, we're on different sides, but that's just fine, and in fact, it's necessary. I don't want a world where everybody believes at me, because, to quote a favorite movie of mine, to paraphrase a favorite movie of mine, Rudy, from years back, in 60 years of living, I've come to two basic determinations in my life, that there is a mm-hmm. God, and it ain't me. So I know I don't have all the answers.
Go ahead, please. I have, a number of questions, but they mm-hmm. revolve around one major one. But I first want to say, listen to you talk about your job right now and the community that you're in, right? And you don't talk about politics. Mm-hmm. I think immediately, and I will say this did pop into my mind as much as I try to avoid that, is I was like, oh my gosh, I work in volunteer emergency medical services. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what that community is, I work in the suburbs of Virginia, right? And so political beliefs, demographic, there are very few Asian folk mm-hmm. and much less young folk who are, my age, who mm-hmm. who work out in that setting. And so political views are very different. But we are, the concept of always there to support each other, the brotherhood feeling, and I say brotherhood, but I don't mean it in a just male sense. It's very much it's very much growing in that mm-hmm. diversity as well. Beside the point, being able to step away from that and say, we are.
I think. Hmm? Oh, you froze up there for a second. Would you repeat what you say?
Yeah, so I was saying just exactly the sentiment that you expressed, mm-hmm. in any community, you can choose to be, you can choose to have that close sentiment that, we're together, we're working toward a common goal, and not breach that question of politics. And I think, and not just politics in general, but any kind of polarizing questions. And I wanted to ask you, as somebody who has been in, you said in college, you said now in your current work, and of course also in the world of journalism, but when you found yourself in a conversation of contentiousness about either political or something political adjacent, how did you breach those as an individual? How did you approach that? I think that's a really big question I have for you, as more partly as guidance and partly as understanding how you see things that way and how maybe that's changed.
Well, the honest answer is not always successfully. There were times when I would get very passionate and find myself falling into doing exactly what I've complained about here, and just sort of going to my talking points, and the discussions becoming at times quite heated. But I have tried to learn from that, And I really would go back to like some of the discussions or debates I'd have with my dad, and where, you know, especially as I got older, once I got past my, and you'll pardon me for using this because it's there, my college student, I know it all, you know, stage, and I realized that, you know, there might be one or two gaps in my understanding, that, you know, I try to find something in whatever they're saying about which I can concur or agree, you know, and it may be something as generic about, yeah, I think, you know, I think both political parties are, you know, are guilty of this. And, you know, and I wish, what I would like to see is this, and sort of try to steer the conversation towards, okay, we know that we come at this from different angles, but where is that land in between, that real estate that we both can stand on and say, yeah, and you know, comfortably together. You know? Now, if you don't mind me asking you, because, you know, I feel I've talked a lot about myself, where would you sort of define yourself politically? And if you don't mind me even saying, even spiritually as well.
Absolutely. I love listening to you. So please continue. I am taking in so much right now, and I appreciate it so much. But yeah, so for me personally, politically, again, the boxes and the pigeonholing is a very difficult thing. But I definitely stand in a place of, I see the value in certain points of view, and I stand for that reason in a, I would say, a moderate place right now. I don't always appreciate a lot of the very strong, very, very strong progressive viewpoints that I don't always agree with in the college student sphere and the high school student sphere that I've seen. And I also do not agree with a lot of the opposite side, very strong conservative beliefs, let's say. And so I put myself somewhere in the middle, where I'm still really consider myself a learner and explorer, where I'm trying to fully understand, because I haven't had the conversations with everyone. And it's very hard for me to say, okay, I'm steadfast one place or another. Definitely progressive leaning, I think, is the appropriate and fair thing to say here. Spiritually, I do not identify with the religion. Agnostic is kind of what I go with right now. I grew up not really in a very religious family, technically Hindu, but not super, super observant, like some of the other folks in the Asian community that I was, you know, grew up with. So that's where I stand in that world. Yeah. Okay. What about yourself, spiritually then? Because we talked about.
Well, the way I say it again, to get away from the hard ones, is I identify as a Christian. I mean, that's the tradition I was brought up in. Even though I did not major or minor in it, I took a lot of religion courses in college because it's always been an area of intense interest for me. But, you know, so when my bride and I got married some, you know, almost 33 years ago, you know, or when we started dating, you know, she's what you call a cradle Episcopalian. She was raised in the Episcopalian church. So she really wanted to go to the Episcopalian church. You know, I had been raised in another denomination, but I thought, you know, that's fine, you know, because we did want our daughter to, you know, have some sort of a faith background. And I found that I really, really connected with the church in terms of, you know, it's not just in terms of not just a lot of its theology, but in terms of its social conscience and whatever. And so I did end up, you know, getting confirmed and becoming a member. But even within that space, you know, there's much in the liturgy that I still, you know, have issues with. We have a prayer book we use. It's called the Book of Common Prayer. And, you know, as we go through the liturgy, you know, each Sunday, there are, you know, there's still language in there that I think is patriarchal, that I would like to see, you know, adjusted at some time. There are concepts in there you know, the I guess the without getting too far afield, but the best way I can answer it is I do believe in God in the sense of a force in this universe that you know, works within all of us. But the way that it's typically understood in popular culture is something that I have issues with. And I'll just use an example from many years ago. When my daughter was 19, she was not living at home. She came by the house one night as we were preparing dinner and visited with us for a while, and then got up to leave to go see her friends. And it was a very wet and rainy evening, kind of, you know, day like today. And that night as we were getting ready for bed, for some reason, I just had a uneasy feeling, you know, about something. And I did something that I do pray, but I did something quite unusual in that before I got into bed, I knelt at the side of the bed and just prayed to please God, you know, look over my daughter tonight. Well, 2 o'clock that morning, we get a knock on the door, and it's a local police officer to inform us that our daughter had been in a car accident. Now, the good news is she was, you know, she got a little sore and banged up, but she was okay. No broken bones, no serious, you know, she completely survived, completely recovered. And, you know, in reflecting on that later, you know, there was almost an innate impulse to say, wow, God spoke to me that night, and I prayed for my daughter, and God spared my daughter. But as I started to think more deeply about that, I wondered about other folks, pardon me, sorry, who got a knock on the door that night and got very different news. And I thought to myself, if I really believed that because I knelt down and prayed that night that what I see as God decided to spare my daughter and yet let somebody else perish because they didn't, pardon me, I could not continue worshiping that kind of God. You know, I have to believe that that if God exists as I believe it is, then, you know, it's there, we are all embraced equally, not in spite of our differences or in spite of our brokenness, but precisely because of that. And that, you know, there things happen in this life that are tragic, that are unfair, that are brutal, and there's not somebody up there pulling the levers. That's just life as we experience it. And where I find my realization of God is when I've been through those times when I felt like I was nearly at the end of my rope. The community of support that has come around me in terms of friends, family, my church community, coworkers, that is where I experience God, you know, in my life.
I'm really grateful that you brought up spirituality. That I usually, for a long time, and still oftentimes, is completely shut down religion. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I don't know where it comes from exactly, but I've always been like, religion's ridiculous. And mm-hmm. and I sit here and I think like, to me, like, that's the whatever, right, like you said, whatever it was, whatever happens, right? If part of your things being okay, I don't have the right words right now, but things being okay was you being able to sit down and think about that. To me, that's just so, that what else could you have? Like, that's powerful. It is. And I see what you're saying, right? Like, if the opposite side, right? The other knock on the door. And I see that too. And I think in the end, what really matters is that, at least in my mind, is that you were able to sit down and pray, right? And that gave you comfort. Is that fair to say?
I think that's spot on. I mean, and I've thought about that a lot, Rishi, over the years, and said, okay, so if I don't believe in the concept of a God that intervenes in our reality, why pray at all? And what I've come to, I think, in that is the sense that, I don't know if you've ever been involved in talk therapy. I have. But, just sometimes in conversation, like we do here, as we talk through our beliefs and our issues and stuff like that, as we're going through that experience of talking, we can sort of crystallize and manifest the things that are important to us in our lives, or the how we want to deal with some of the challenges of our lives. And I think in my approach to prayer, that's kind of what I'm doing. It's not so much that I'm saying, hey God, intervene in this, make this go away. I'm talking through it with the universe, saying these are the things that are really weighing down on me right now. And hopefully through that process, I start becoming more aware of, okay, what are the ways that I can deal with this? What are the resources I can avail myself of? Do I need to ask for help? And those things. So it's kind of prayer to me is kind of a conversation with myself and with the universe at large to help me realize that, however isolated I'm feeling right now, I'm truly not alone. I do have a community of support around me, and that I can get through whatever it is that is weighing on me at that time.
I think I appreciate that so much more listening to you. And I want to thank you for that. I actually, interestingly, you brought up the Episcopalian Church, and I have I've both in the past 2 years spent a lot of time working with the Episcopalian Church and worked for them and volunteered with them. We have a great soup kitchen that we do. So I've been very involved with that. And I showed up there as someone who knew nothing about religion and then was, brought into just the education side of, like, here's what we do, here's what we value. And it's right, the social focus, the let's like the value focus is so meaningful. And I it makes me, I don't really know how to preach the idea of the other side of my perception of the church as an entity, as an organization that imposes, in my mind, imposes certain beliefs as well, that not only do I don't not always agree with, but it feels like a, I always thought it was brainwashing, to be completely frank. And I don't like saying that because I'd like to believe that everyone has their own independent, ability to figure out what they want for themselves. But that side of not only, I mean, very much strongly in politics, but also just as, like, human beings who don't agree with each other. I think about homophobia as a big one, actually, that comes to mind. I think about the abortion question is just the two biggest ones that are, like, always glaring at me, in the news and just in conversation. And I don't know, how do you, are you able to kind of reconcile those two things in any way? Have you thought, have you kind of been able to breach those?
Well, I mean, my personal belief is that, I have said for years, I think, the LGBTQ issue is one of the key civil rights issues of our day. And, and one of the reasons I've remained in the Episcopal Church is we were among the first of the mainline denominations to ordain, you know, LGBTQ bishops, you know. So, you know, that's just a fundamental issue for me. Again, you know, I think, you know, you say control, and, you know, control is, I think, an important term, because I think religion, like anything else, once it becomes institutionalized, and once there's a hierarchy in place, there is a certain amount of controlling of behavior and attitudes that takes place. So, you know, I you know, for myself, I find I have to operate within, I operate within the framework of an institutionalized church, one that I think is, you know, much more inclusive than a lot in society, but I also reserve the right to maintain my independence from the institution when I feel it veers away from what I believe is true. In terms of the abortion issue, you know, I just come down to a very, very simple thing. I just think that, you know, we talk about pigeonholing and stuff. When I hear the term pro-life, you know, I think, you know, life begins at birth, it doesn't end there. And that, you know, if we're going to want to, quote, as you hear sometimes, celebrate a culture of life, then it has to be not just through the birth process, but what happens to that child afterwards. And, you know, and depending on, you know, do they have access to the things that are necessary in this life to grow into a safe and nurturing and environment that will let them, you know, have the opportunity to succeed. So, you know, without getting too much again into the fault lines, you know, I just feel like a lot of our political discussions, I think we get caught up in certain, we get caught up in the fringe areas, and we need to have a larger discussion about, you know, the implications of the policies that we say we support or oppose.
I think one thing that I continuously struggle with when it comes to, I mean, really the big idea of polarization, is that I can always find the, and I say argument, but as in the perspective on the other side that I might not all fully agree with. And to me, it's like, your perspective is totally valid in its own right. Right? And I'm never gonna say, okay, like what you're saying is completely irrational or illogical, because to me, logic is kind of this, I'm not going to get into a conversation of semantics. Let's not do that. But the point is, everyone sees the benefit of something and the drawbacks of something differently. It's always defined differently. And where they value each of the drawbacks and each of the benefits and the ones they see and they don't see and they choose to see and choose not to see, it's all different, right? So by their point of view, right, the net benefit could be something. Whereas from my point of view, I look at different costs and different benefits. And so it ends up being a different answer. And I think for me, I'm usually able to some degree, see, okay, your costs and benefits are different. I can't tell you that your costs and benefits are not what they are. And being able to go into that and say, well, now what? Because we're both right, but we're not, and right is not really the right word, but we're both in our own minds saying something that has value to us. And there's the question of who it imposes that effect on, right? Because it becomes politics and policymaking. And I have not really figured out how to say, okay, well, we're both coming from a place where we understand the world a certain way. What is the approach? Because the compromise is you pick one or the other. You don't really, and maybe that's the question, right? You were saying the gray area, we're treated so black and white. I don't know what you think. I'm kind of going on a thought that I can't really put into words, but I want to see what you think about that.
Well, I would just say I get where you're coming from, and but I would, you know, what was going through my mind, you're saying we're both right. I was thinking, well, and you didn't want to use the word right. We're both valid. You know, we're valid because we've come to whatever we believe due to our own life experience, what we've seen, what we've read, what we've heard, you know, so it's valid. But again, you know, when we get to the policy, I think that's the thing. And that's where I think the breakdown comes, is that it becomes about who's right and who's wrong, and not about, you know, how can we do this in a way that's going to have the maximum benefit for the most people. And that's where, you know, like I think we've both agreed about, that's kind of why we're here today, is because that's where we have to come, is from a standpoint of validation for both sides. Not because you believe this, you don't care about, you know, unborn children, or because you believe this, you don't care about women. Mm-hmm. But because, like, okay, you feel very strongly about this. This may be a part of your, you know, core belief system, you know, and whatever, you know, your faith perspective is. But have you considered this? And then sort of let's go from there.
I really do appreciate that. And it comes back to exactly what you were saying about common ground. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that really caught my attention as you were speaking here is the best answer the one that benefits the most amount of people? Because mm-hmm. I think you said that, but I want mm-hmm. to look at that a second time, because I both agree and disagree with that sentiment. Okay. Because in a way that's majority pleasing, which is not a good thing or a bad thing, it's just something that we have to consider, I think. Anna, what do you think about that statement? Is that something you believe or agree with? The best option?
Well, you know, what I believe is, you know, when we say majority pleasing, I don't think we should necessarily, I don't want to be in a society where majority rules, because majority sometimes can be wrong. But mm-hmm. I think in terms of policy, we should always be striving for what's going to be the greatest good for the greatest number of people, because that is, I think, where the role of a government comes in, to provide for the, again, as I said earlier in our discussion, the most justice for the majority of the people, but not in the sense that, okay, 65% of the people believe this, which means only 45 believe this, so 65% is the right answer, because we've seen in history that doesn't work, and we, I think, have to so thank you for your questions and for your feedback. This has been just a wonderfully, this has been everything I hoped for.
I am so happy. It was wonderful talking to you, Chris, and I'm taking a lot from this, and really am excited to to go into reflecting on this conversation, spending more time with it. And it was so lovely. I appreciate your vulnerability. That's something that is very hard to find. And one thing about this space, but especially you chose to do that. And I am very grateful for you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, and ditto.